This is the happiness quotient. It never ceases to amaze me in the way people are brought into your life. Today's guest, I discovered when I began researching the garbage and human waste problems on Mount Everest and in the Khumbu region of Nepal. In episode number 90, and in a recent streaming event about the garbage and human waste problem on Everest, I discussed how Everest has been referred to as the highest garbage dump on the planet. Among the several guests on the program, I spoke with entrepreneur and businesswoman Diana Youssef of Change Water Labs, a new company based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, working to help the human waste problems affecting much of the world's population. Consider this. Half of the world's population has no running water or flush toilets. Change Water Labs has developed an incredible toilet called the iThrone, which removes the water content from human waste. Change Water Labs has developed a low-cost, compact, waterless toilet for non-sewered households and communities. Change Water Labs' mission is to develop and deploy safer, smarter, more dignified sanitation globally. 3 billion people lack safe toilet access, and 1 billion defecate openly. Chronic underinvestment into sanitation infrastructure means people in many poor and vulnerable communities live with their sewage. With no toilets or pipes, there is no way to flush. I spoke with founder and CEO Diana Youssef about their work and posited if it might be a viable option on Mount Everest. Here's my conversation with Diana Youssef of Change Water Labs. This isn't a problem unique to Mount Everest. Probably mm-hmm. the unique aspect of it is that the people there, most of them have a lot of money in relatively speaking. And it's kind of sad that this problem hasn't been dealt with and fixed. Yeah. And it might be, you could blame it on the government perhaps, but that's kind of lame. So I thought maybe I could ask you, in making that connection, tell me a little bit about your organization and how it got started, and then maybe we can draw distinctions to Mount Everest.
Right. It's funny. First of all, regarding Mount Everest, I mean, a couple of years ago, somebody was saying, oh, wouldn't that be a great, like, sort of project to get visibility to what you were doing if you figured out a partner to do this on Everest? So, I mean, we did, you know, at the time we were still head down in the lab, so there wasn't really a thought of that. But just, it's funny that, you know, this isn't the first time I've heard about the issue. So I have to say that the idea started in a venue that is much higher than Everest. Back in 2009, I was consulting to NASA on ideas around recycling water for the space station. So, because they also have a problem with, you know, resources on the space station, and, you know, you can't throw things out and you can't turn on the faucet and expect more water to come out. You only have the water that you bring up with you. And so I was looking at a portfolio of ideas with them around recycling water on the space station. And one idea that was mentioned kind of in passing, and they didn't really do much with it, was, oh, you know, could breathable materials, so these are the materials that we kind of know, like similar to, you know, dry fit, you know, like the stuff that you have in your, you know, high-tech sportswear that keeps you dry while you're working out. Couldn't we use breathable materials as a way to passively separate water away from contaminants or away from waste? And in doing that, you know, you're essentially pulling out the molecular water, leaving the waste behind. And then you can take that molecular water and use it again and again, because it's really just pure water. And so I kind of, you know, it just caught my attention. I was like, you know, this is, I mean, I come from a background of kind of a hodgepodge, but one of the things that's been a driver for me is trying to use science and technology as a way to solve problems in developing countries. And mm-hmm. maybe the reason for that is because my parents are immigrants from a developing country, and specifically they're from the Middle East, and water is sort of top priority in the Middle East. So I guess it's not a big surprise that I kept thinking about what are we going to do with water? And so, you know, as a scientist, it makes sense to me that, you know, trying to find a low energy way to treat water or to get rid of wastewater would be a really good thing to do, especially in for places that are low resource, like developing countries. And you know, I sort of made the connection, like, yes, the space station is the ultimate off-grid location, but there are plenty of off-grid locations here on Earth. And couldn't we use this as a low energy, low cost way to essentially deal with dirty water, essentially. And so, so back in 2013, I finally kind of just, you know, decided, you know, I'm going to drop everything else and start working on trying to figure this out. And I didn't have a technology at the time. I didn't have anything at the time, just this half-baked idea. And, but over time, you know, just was able to garner the resources and the team and the champions. And, you know, initially that was the other thing was that, you know, I'm a scientist by background. So, you know, I look at waste and I see it's, you know, it's a mix of things, but 95% of human waste is water. And, you know, if you pull out that water, you shrink the problem down to something much more manageable, something much safer, something much lower cost to deal with. And so I just kept thinking of this as like, there's got to be a way that we can help solve this problem by subtracting the water part. And initially, you know, people said that's not a thing. And I'm like, it has to be a thing. If 95% of what we're dealing with is water, and the big problem is you can't flush it away, and if you have to carry it around to get rid of it, that just can't be easy and it can't be pleasant. And, you know, it must be really costly. I just figured, you know, if we just take the water part out, then all of that becomes much easier. And better yet, you take the water out and you put it back in nature in its cleanest form, you know, this becomes a much more sustainable solution. So it was initially, you know, poo-pooed, not to, you know, I guess we're not going to avoid any, that wasn't meant to be a toilet pun, but right. That was, yeah, but it was initially dismissed as kind of like, you know, that's not a thing. But now when I talk about it, people are like, duh, of course, you know, if you can't flush it, shrink it. And so, so that's what we've been, you know, that's kind of what we worked on. That's what we worked towards. And, we're starting to work on deployments in some of these places that don't have any, you know, waste removal infrastructure or water infrastructure. And so I'm sorry. Of course. I thought I turned off my phone. You can edit that out, right?
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. I didn't really even hear it.
Oh, okay. It was, yeah, it rings on my telephone. I mean, on my computer. Anyway, backing up. So yeah, so that's what we've been working on. And, you know, of course, trying, you know, it's a really obvious use case to put this in remote areas where, you know, you're trying to protect a really pristine natural ecosystem, especially one that starts to, you know, become more trafficked with human beings. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it's close to our heart, you know, to, you know, and also toilets are a way that you can essentially deliver huge social impact and huge environmental impact, you know, with just one intervention.
Yeah. So on the website, I thought that was, it's really, it's great website. And it, you know, talks about some great stats in there that are sad, but 40% of the world lacks access to safe sanitation.
It's actually 50%.
Is it really?
Yeah, the sort of the latest numbers out of, I think it was the Gates Foundation that put it out. Yeah. Half of us don't have access to safely managed sanitation.
It's a shocking number. And I think we're mildly aware of it. Someone like me, the first time I ever, you know, encountered that directly was, I suppose, some of the early trips I took into Nepal and Pakistan and places like that on climbing trips. And you'd stop and you'd stay out near a village or something, and they would have, you know, where you would use as the restroom, but it was basically a plywood board and a hole in it. Yeah. And it was shocking. And in a way, I thought, wow, this is not sustainable. And then of course you leave and you're on to the next village, and it's like, okay, well, the problem's gone technically, I suppose, for that individual. And, you know, but when I was in Annapurna back in 1993 or 92, I believe it was, I was offered a drink from a gentleman who was managing a small little hut there in the base camp. And he handed a glass to me, and to be polite, I accepted. And I was like, oh, this is not going to be good. And I took a drink out of the glass and I saw a drip of water on it. And I not only got sick, I got cholera.
Yeah.
And it was, wow, like, I know now why so many people die from that disease. We had a kit loaded with drugs.
Yeah.
You know, we were just these rich Westerners, relative term that is, but I was better in, you know, 48 hours or less, actually. So the problem is not an esoteric one. It's dramatic. People are dying around the world because of this problem.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about the implementation? I believe it's in one refugee camp that you're putting this to work, and how is that working now?
Yeah, so actually it's a refugee hosting community. So we it's hard to get into refugee camps. We were sponsored on a grant that was called Humanitarian Grand Challenges Grant. It was funded by a consortium of, I think, the USAID, the British Development Agency, DFID, and the Dutch Foreign Ministry, and administered by a Canadian organization called Grand Challenges Canada. And it was pretty generous grant that got us from essentially lab to pilot. And we chose, we had some partnerships building up in a community in Uganda, a district called Chiboga, which is kind of, it's one of the adjacent districts to where I guess Kampala is. It's a poor part of Uganda where the place where we deployed was basically, I think the population was probably about 40% Rwandan refugees. Mm. So, and Uganda is a big host country for refugees. I think like 1% of the population are refugees from all the African countries that have had all the conflicts and the ongoing conflicts that border Uganda. Mm. So we were, and we were essentially hosted on the ground of a hospital. And, many people in this community do not have, you know, toilets in their homes, and there isn't proper water and flushing infrastructure. And this hospital, you know, we were hosted next to the neonatal unit, which kind of initially terrified me how close we were to a bunch of postpartum moms and tiny infants, because I wasn't sure it would work, to be honest with you. But it's, you know, these women travel, you know, having been pregnant, they travel and, you know, go into labor, and, you know, they and their families have to somehow figure out how to house themselves and host themselves and manage themselves in a place that's not near their home. And the bathrooms are, you know, they were pit latrines. You walk up a hill, you know, up behind the hospital, and they were pit latrines. And unpleasant, dirty, you know, not convenient to get to, you know, placed at a distance from the hospital for a good reason. Mm-hmm. And we always were trying to solve the problem of how do you put toilets closer to where people live in a way that doesn't, you know, sicken them or bother them. So mm-hmm. it doesn't smell, doesn't leak. And that was the target. And so when we, in February, March of 2020, my team landed in Chiboga, Uganda, to essentially deploy our first iThrone toilets. That's what it's called, an iThrone. And we were deploying it on the grounds of the hospital. My team actually stayed there until the toilet was working. So we went through a couple of, you know, on the ground, on site iterations to improve, wow. you know, what we sent, just to make sure we left behind something that would work. Also, the other reason was because I wasn't sure I could, you know, at that time in the startup, I did not have a lot of money in the bank account. Wasn't sure if I could afford the return ticket. So they didn't know that, but sorry, yeah. It was all good. And luckily we got the toilets working before March 13th of 2020, which is when we had to evacuate everybody because flights from countries into the US were shutting down. So that was exciting. It was insane. Yeah. We left the toilets behind and, you know, unfortunately we wanted to run a 3-month pilot, and then be able to go back. But you know, obviously that wasn't possible. So we ended up running a 3-week pilot. So it ran for a couple of weeks after we left. But what we were able to demonstrate was that we had, you know, 400 users using it. They were all women and girls, all universally felt it was a dignified, positive, clean experience. So it was really something that they appreciated from the feedback that we got. And it kept the waste, you know, hygienically contained. So there wasn't any leak, you know, outside. It also didn't smell like the, you know, if there was a smell that came out of the toilet, it was really more of like a farmy, earthy smell. So you really wasn't unpleasant. And it proved out the kind of operational point was that we were seeing 6 to 10 times volume reduction of the waste on site. So it's essentially, you know, quote unquote, flushing it away by evaporating the liquid content or the water content. So, and really what that translates into from a operations and an economic standpoint is, you know, you have less waste. You're actually converting a lot of that waste back into clean molecular water. And you're reducing the frequency, the energy, and the cost of having to collect the on-site waste. Because normally, if you don't do anything with that volume, it either stays there and, you know, poisons the community and the ecosystem, or if you have to collect it, it, you know, really starts to become unpleasant. You have to collect it quite frequently. So, and that's just, you know, these communities that already start with an underinvestment in infrastructure aren't going to be able to bear the ongoing cost. Mm. So that was kind of what we were targeting was, you know, how do you bring the costs in line and also do something where you're creating a more sustainable solution? And so our, you know, we kind of call it the green toilet. The iThrone is the green toilet. It's saves money and the planet. Yeah. Cause it also doesn't use water too.
Yeah. Incredible. So can you just kind of create a visual and if somebody was even closing their eyes and there was no design or graphics on the wall, how does it work?
Okay. So the overall structure is basically a box that, you know, you can either sit on or squat over, and inside of the box are two evaporative bags. And these evaporative bags are made out of a membrane material that we invented called, well, we call it shrink wrap for crap. And so gotta have a
pretty
catchy
easy to
tune.
Remember
yeah,
that.
Very, yeah. Yeah, very, very, yeah, good visual. So yeah, so basically solid waste goes in one of the bags, liquid waste goes in the other bag. And then this material essentially swells by absorbing the water content from the waste. And so urine is almost 100% water. Feces, actually raw feces, is surprisingly you know, 75 to 85% water. So, so it basically pulls the water into the membrane, and then the membrane, quote unquote, sweats. So that water comes out on the other side. So everything else is stays inside the bag, but the water comes out, and it comes out and you don't see it because you're pulling out molecular water. By definition, mm-hmm. molecular water is gas. Mm-hmm. So if you know, what you would notice is, you know, if you had like a humidity reader around, you know, on the outside of the toilet, you would notice the humidity going up. Mm-hmm. And so essentially the iThrone pulls out the water and releases it to the air as clean, pure molecular water vapor.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so how many people for how long can use it?
Yeah, it's designed to do, to have 30 to 50 uses per day for 4 weeks. And wow. Initially when we were sort of, you know, when we thought we were going to start with a household toilet, we spec'd it that way because, you know, if you assume a household is 6 to 10 people and you want that ends up being, you know, a healthy person with a proper diet will go to the bathroom 5 times a day. So that's where we got the 30 to 50 uses target. And then we wanted to reduce the servicing frequency to something between 2 and 4 weeks. So that, you know, it really, because, you know, again, the comparable is container-based toilets that get serviced every 1 to 2 days, and it's just not scalable cost. You know, it's cost prohibitive in a lot of these places. It's just, yeah. And yeah, it's very difficult to maintain, you know, current options around container-based toilets.
Yeah. So, have you even found if there's an actual cost to this right now? Like, so if somebody said, I want to buy one of those, could they do it? Or
right now we are not set up to do that. But what we plan to do is work with partners in the different markets to then, you know, have them be the, you know, sort of distribution. I mean, mm-hmm. we'll sell the bags. Mm-hmm. But the toilets themselves will be sold by our partners in the regions, because it's really hard for us from the United States to ship a bunch of these heavy boxes. You know, they're not big. I mean, they're you know, cut, like, you know, the dimensions on them are, you know, I'd say, like, I'm looking at my filing cabinet, which is my IKEA filing cabinet. It's probably like, if you lay that on its side, probably, you know, three stacked high, maybe one and a half stacked wide.
Sure.
So it's not huge,
but it's
bulky. And so right now the distribution model, I mean, so we're not at the point where we're commercially available. Mm-hmm. We are planning that in the next 12 months. And initially, you know, for us as a startup, the best way to sell these is through businesses and, you know, who can install them, service mm-hmm. them, manufacture them, distribute them, and also then sell to governments and NGOs. Mm-hmm. So who can purchase in bulk. Mm-hmm. You know, eventually I think we do want to do something like we actually have a design for a camping version of this that we call the iGo. iGo. That's a smaller version that probably will go for like a consumer market, but we've had such kind of aggressive pent-up demand for the, you know, the toilet that, you know, gets installed into homes, into institutions, into transportation equipment, into porta potties, that we're not able to work on the iGo right now to get it to completion, mm-hmm. but a couple of years. So 2 years maybe.
So is there, like, in literal terms though, if let's just say somebody wanted, like, just said, could you make me a prototype?
Right.
I want to buy it and I'm going to bring it and test it on Mount Everest. Like, I don't know if you can actually say a number, but
I think, well, so the cost to me right now to make it is not at scale. Right. So it's about, you know, so we're right now, it would cost me 3 to 5 times to make it as what we would you know, charge for it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're looking at, you know, a couple $100 for the toilet, and then, you know, once it's at scale. So, but if somebody wants to, you know, if an organization wants to buy it right now, when we're not at scale, probably, you know, probably 3 to 5X on that just to cover our costs. But I think, so, but yeah, it's not meant to be expensive. I mean, we, you know, we always, I mean, it's also not, you know, the sort of the iThrone isn't necessarily, we weren't targeting a consumer, you know, like sales, like it's not retail really. Generally that's, you know, most, you know, hardware appliances and household, like, you know, plumbing type things don't get sold that way. So I mean, I think, you know, like if you were saying, oh, you're planning on charging a couple $100 to poor people, you know, to buy a toilet, that wasn't really the idea.
No, not at all, for sure.
You know, and it's tough. I mean, as a business, we have to be kind of practical about how we get it to the market, you know, in a scalable way. But yeah, I think it's also, we wanted to keep the discipline of not having something complex. It doesn't have a lot of moving parts. You know, we always had the reality check of, we're trying to design something for a low resource context. So you can't assume plug-in into plumbing, into power. You can't assume that people, like, I mean, you have to keep the cost low, you know, not only the operational cost, but also the upfront cost has to be relatively low. And so when we look at comparable toilets that are sort of having, you know, similar performance, you know, we see, you know, the costs end up, you know, we end up being 4 to 5 times less in terms of cost. Wow. So, and it's really just meant to be us, you know, it really, the technology allows us to create something simple, because it's really, we're leveraging material science as a way to do all the work.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really encouraging that things like this are happening, you know, on a place like Mount Everest, where the majority of the people come from privileged backgrounds. And, you know, a lot of the people who work there, I will say, aren't so. But they make decent wages during the time of those expeditions.
Right.
One of the programs that has been discussed is a biogas kind of building that they were going to build. To replace what the system is now, as they go, there's these big 50, 60 gallon drums that get carried,
You know,
a couple of hours away and dug in and poured into a pit near a tiny little village that I don't believe people live there in the winter. It's like it's at 17, 16,000 feet in elevation. But it's got to end. And the crowds on Everest in Nepal are only increasing. So this, something of this nature is encouraging what you're working on, because the biogas program is going to cost upwards of $500,000. Mm-hmm. And people just aren't motivated to give a lot of money.
Yeah.
If they gave $100, now that's something, but you know, 600 thou, you're going to have somebody really want to believe in that and then put the time in and build it, maintain it. So perhaps there's some, you know, if you have a prototype or wanted to see how that worked on Mount Everest, I know a lot of people, expedition organizers, who might be interested in at least, you know, doing a little case study for you.
Yeah, which
might
for sure.
Be interesting.
Yeah, we'd love that. I mean, I think, you know, again, you know, we, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, are you a, you know, are you targeting sustainability impact? Are you environmental impact? Are you targeting social impact? And I can never answer that question one way or the other. Yeah. I don't see them. I see them as completely linked. I mean, especially, you know, climate change and environmental, you know, degradation, it impacts, you know, these low resource communities most, you know, it has the most impact on these low resource communities. And, you know, for us, like being able to, you know, be part of an effort to uplift you know, people, you know, the people in that region, as well as, you know, maintain such a, you know, a global treasure, would be really, I mean, that's sort of why we started. I mean, there are a couple of motivations, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of, I mean, for you to get to the point where you decide, like, you're going to give up everything else you did in your life or that you're doing in your life to work on toilets, you have to have a couple of motivations and you have to be really compelled by, you know,
crazy,
probably not in high demand for your, you know, other job opportunities. And then on top of that, no, but I think also, like, I have three daughters and I think, you know, every day I'm thinking about what kind of a planet we're leaving for them. Mm-hmm. But I'm also thinking about, you know, and you didn't ask this, but, you know, another motivation for us was, you know, how do you create more gender parity in a lot of these low resource communities? And poor sanitation has such a huge impact disproportionately on girls and women. And, you know, in terms of their safety, in terms of their dignity, in terms of their privacy, in terms of their health, in terms of, you know, girls' access to education. And then on top of that, there's, you know, just the fact that, you know, what we do for sanitation right now is hugely destructive to the planet, even in developed countries. I mean, you know, we output on a given day, you know, what, like a liter bottle of Coke's worth of waste. And, you know, we often are using basically a bathtub's worth of clean water just to flush it away, just to move it. Wow. And that's just not sustainable. So if you're trying to get the other half of the world onto dignified, proper, clean sanitation, it's not going to be flush toilets. Mm. And it's not going to be flush toilets for the rest of us for long. You know, I'll fully admit I'm not ready to part with my flush toilet and replace it with an iThrone in my own house. So maybe I'm the biggest hypocrite of all, but I will say that at some point, you know, it's not happening for all of us. Like, we are, you know, the infrastructure is crumbling. There isn't enough clean water. And then on top of that, raw, wet sewage, spits out 4% of methane emissions. So it's actually, you know, if we're talking about dealing with climate change, dealing with our sanitation issue in a way that cuts off methane emissions is going to be key. Mm. So, and it's an ignored problem because nobody knows how to measure it. Right. So yeah, all of these problems are just like, really, if you can't measure it, and water issues around water, water sustainability, wastewater treatment, you know, all of that is just much harder to measure than, you know, really any other kind of waste, because it flows, it blends with clean resources, it's local, but it's global. Mm-hmm. I mean, this might be sort of a very abstract way to explain it, but, you know, when we were trying to figure out how to measure the environmental impact of what we were proposing to do, you just can't, it's really hard to find the numbers. And it doesn't mean that the impact doesn't exist. I mean, I'm a biochemist by training. I understand what happens when you add water to microbes and waste, you know, what kind of reaction you get. And one of them is you generate methane. Mm. And so, you know, there's definitely this invisible contributor to climate change. And, you know, we got to do something about it.
Mm. Wow. That's really fantastic. I hope that we can continue to, you know, talk in the future. Because, you know, I think there are a couple of challenges probably on Mount Everest. One is it gets really cold at night.
Yeah.
So that probably changes things a little bit. But it gets really hot during the day, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's still ways to try to solve that problem. And we all know what the resources of some of the people who are on Mount Everest are really, you know, there's some very wealthy people up there. And I, you know, in terms of this idea, I would love to, I don't even know if this is a possibility, but maybe someday, I don't know if you have a facility or where this is made, but maybe come down and interview you and say, so here it is. This is the membrane. This is how it works. And here's how we make it, even though that might be proprietary. I film all sorts of stuff.
No, like, we can do a demo. Not now, because we're moving, and also like the only functioning toilets right now are in Uganda. But you know, so, and we're, it's so crazy because we're really just starting to get back into our prototyping space, and the rules everywhere are crazy. Like one of the places where we have prototyping space, you have to, like, even if you're vaccinated, you have to take a COVID, you have to prove a negative, like a negative COVID test within, you know, like in order to get back into that space. So we're now splitting ourselves to another space, and, you know, all the rules around how do you get back to work and working with people in a shared space. It's like, so we're navigating that, but we're really excited because we're, you know, we're within the month, we're going to be building the next version of the iThrone. And this is in collaboration with partners in Panama. And the idea is to get waterless, safe, clean sanitation, improved sanitation to indigenous communities in Panama that live beyond the reaches of infrastructure. So we're potentially targeting 150,000 households, or more than 600,000 people who have never had a toilet, and they live up in the mountains. And so we're actually going to be doing some, you know, in the mountains. So, you know, maybe that might be, maybe you can join me down there when I go to take a look. All right.
I'm serious. I would love that.
Well, that's this fall. So
it's important. Okay. Well,
yeah, we'll be in touch.
I mean that. And I do, from the bottom of my heart, because I'm always game for an adventure.
If you'd like to learn more about Diana Youssef and the iThrone, visit Change Water Labs' website at change-water.com. Thank you, Diana. I look forward to visiting your labs in the very near future. Please share this episode with anyone that might find these words inspiring or helpful or educational or informational. I rely on the kindness of my listeners, that's you, to share and to subscribe to The Happiness Quotient on Apple Podcasts or wherever you may listen. And please, while you're at it, click some stars and leave me a review. That is the only way I get out there. All of my answers came, driving myself insane. Thank you to the Wood Brothers for their gracious permission for the use of their song, Happiness Jones. If you'd like to join my mailing list, you can email me at tom.dharma.pollard@gmail.com. If you'd like a free PDF download of A Course in Happiness, go to patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, where you'll find a free, colorful issue replete with adventure photography. We'll be back next time with another excellent interview on The Happiness Quotient. Thank you for visiting. I will see you all real soon. Happiness Jones.